Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, community radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. You can also catch the show at 8 a.m. on the third Monday, and our show and every show can be streamed at krfy.org. from anywhere in the world. If you enjoy podcasts, you can even listen to a podcast of the show at krfy.org and select the podcast tab. Today, we will be discussing Alzheimer's disease, as November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. I have here with me in the studio Mary Moreland, author of The Gap Between Loving and Supporting Someone with Alzheimer's. Mary, tell us a bit about yourself and your journey as a caregiver and author.
Well, thank you, Dr. Joanne. First, I want to thank you for having me and tell you how excited I am to be here and to be in Sandpoint. I actually live in Houston, but I have a place in Dover, and I'm looking forward to spending more and more time in this beautiful place. And I've really been looking forward to our chat today. So my caregiving journey was with my mother. And she was diagnosed in 2011. And I remember that day so clearly when my dad called me and I was at work and he told me about that. And we had a short discussion about caregiving. We had a few different discussions of what that would look like. And then one day I was going to my parents' home. I was actually picking out cell phones for them because they had refused to have cell telephones. And I had decided that they really needed them, which, as a side note, it was very funny because my father told me that his phone would be only for outbound calls and not inbound calls. So I had to explain to him why inbound calls would be good too. And I called my mom. I was going to pick her up. We were going to go to the cell phone store and pick one out that she really liked. She said, you know, I don't think your dad feels very well. I think that I should stay home with him and you just pick out something that I like. You know exactly what I like. And I did know exactly what she liked. And then I came home. I provided the phone. She asked me if I'd, you know, check on dad. And she was right. He didn't feel very well because he had actually passed away in his sleep, which I knew I would fall into the role of caregiver. I knew I was number two in line, but I didn't expect it to happen like that. And, you know, life proceeds. You never know what's going to happen in life. You know, there are ups and downs. Things happen that you don't expect. And I just remember looking at her at that moment. And I think I can say this now because time has passed. I just thought, I'm now responsible for you. Like, I basically, and Alzheimer's, people with Alzheimer's, living with Alzheimer's are not children. They are not. They are, you know, mature people. But I just thought, I have a third human to look after now. And where is mom going to sleep tonight? All these practical questions just jumped into my head that I really hadn't thought about. So anyway, that was the beginning of my caregiving journey. And I really wrote the book as an Alzheimer's 101 to help other people because I learned so much through that journey and give kind of practical advice.
Okay, that's so interesting. And I know that one of the things that helped you through it was journaling. So we can talk about that a little bit later. Susie Perez is also here with us today. Susie is the host of our Wednesday morning show, and I call her my executive producer, as she enables us to broadcast Medical Musings. Good morning, Susie.
Good morning, Dr. Joanne. And I just want to say Medical Musing provides the KRFY listeners interesting and informative interviews, as you say, on a variety of medical and health-related subjects. And I also wanted our listeners to know a little bit about you, Dr. Joanne. You are a longtime KRFY volunteer, previously hosting segments of Otto's Eclectic Mix, and now hosting Medical Musing the first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. You're a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010. previously working at a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics once you moved here. As the media spokesperson for the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, you contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. So perfect place for you to be right here with us. You're also a mother of four adult children, and we're fortunate to have your show, Medical Musing, as part of our Monday morning programming. So thank you, Dr. Joanne.
Well, thank you, Susie. Doing this show has been so much fun because I really love doing the research. It kind of brings me back to my love of medicine. So,
and you're doing a great job.
Well, thank you.
It's amazing.
I'm going to give you a little background about Alzheimer's from the medical perspective, or as I call it, what's important for the community to know about Alzheimer's to break the stigma. Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, causing about 80% of cases. As we know, dementia is a very broad term signifying memory loss. There are several other diagnoses that encompass dementia, but Alzheimer's is a specific disease with the deficiencies in memory, language, thinking, due to an accumulation of beta amyloid and tau protein. And a few statistics. There are 55 million cases in the world, with 7 million here in the U.S. There are probably more by now. Probably this statistic is a year or so old. There are 200,000 people who are young, between ages 30 and 64, which is, again, surprising to many people. They say 10%, some people say a third, of people over age 65 will develop Alzheimer's as they age. And by 2050, we'll probably almost double our rate and have 13 million cases in the U.S. The cases show two-thirds women, which again, we have three women here, and females in females. Blacks have two times the risk, and Hispanics have 1.5 times the risk. And Alzheimer's is also the sixth leading cause of death, higher than prostate cancer and breast cancer combined. Well, that brings us to both your mother's journey with the disease and your journey as a caregiver. People often ask me, being a doc, can I prevent Alzheimer's or dementia? And although there are 10 healthy habits for your brain, they're the same healthy habits for almost everything. Eating well, sleeping well, challenging your mind. Some people say playing bridge, playing mahjong, playing canasta, playing memory games, trivia, being smoke-free. Excuse me, I have to clear my throat. And protecting your head. So here we encourage ski helmets and bike helmets, living in a smoke-free environment, controlling your blood pressure, managing diabetes or not developing it, maintaining the healthy weight and sleeping well. So as I read the book, I went, gee, you actually wrote, Mom did everything to prevent Alzheimer's. Your mom was so very mentally and physically active. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first, I want to acknowledge that those statistics are terrifying, especially if you're someone who has a family history of Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. But I am extremely hopeful about the science, the advancements that have been made. And so I, even when I hear those statistics, I think, wow. But then you need to recognize that right now there's a lot of attention on Alzheimer's. There are a lot of clinical trials. There's a lot of, you know, repurposing of current drugs like the GLP-1 drugs, the statin drugs. There's just a lot of research going on. And what you mentioned, Dr. Joanne, about healthy living, you know, on July 28th of 2025, the U.S. Pointer Study was published, which was a multi-year lifestyle study of over 2,000 people in the U.S., and they had some very positive results from healthy living. And if you don't mind, as we kind of go through, I want to sprinkle through some resources.
Sure.
That might be helpful for people. You know, with regard to healthy living, you can always, of course, go to the Alzheimer's Association website, and they have 10 healthy habits for your brain. But if you really want to try to get into, like, whoa, specifics, the U.S. Pointer study at alls.org, you can find the U.S. Brain Health Recipe, which talks about recommendations for physical exercise, cognitive exercise, health monitoring, and nutrition. And kind of a good rule of thumb, too, is what's good for your heart is going to be good for your brain. Now, you mentioned my mom. And my mom, I think Alzheimer's was one of her biggest fears. And she was physically active, you know, and I think she followed all the recommendations that were available at the time. But thinking back on her life, I can think of a few things that she could have optimized. She never got really great sleep, to be honest. I think sleep is so important, and there's a lot of science about, you know, the benefits of sleep and something called, which you probably know more about, the glycolic system, clearing out, you know, your brain while you sleep. And she was very mentally active, but I don't think, you know, she could have been a lot more socially active. You know, she was a writer. She wrote poetry and short stories. I included a lot of her poems in my book, but that's also a very, you know, isolating activity. So I think things like mahjong, you know, like playing bridge, being around people, you know, going, and this area is so awesome because there's so many great things to do. Being out in nature, you know, is good for you. So she did do healthy things. I think her diet too, she had a quote unquote healthy diet, but look at everything we've learned about food, you know, in the past decade or so, you know? So I used to get, you know, a little sad. I'm not going to be like, I'm just going to be totally honest. And I tried to be just completely authentic in my book, like you came into my living room and sat on my couch and we, you know, and we just chatted. That's the conversational tone of my book. I used to think, gosh, mom did everything she could possibly think of to prevent this disease and she got it and I'm destined to get it. But I really don't feel that way anymore because there are a lot of things out there that you can read about and you can do for yourself.
That's wonderful. Susie?
And just hearing you talk about it, how important research. It's cutting edge, and who knows what's coming, but it sounds like because of those statistics that Joanne mentioned, research is front and center on this and could and hopefully will make a difference because everyone's facing this. And that research, repurposing drugs, you said, you mentioned statins and things like that, is going to be vital as we move forward.
Yes, and I'm so glad you mentioned that because I actually participated in a lifestyle research study called Retain Your Brain. And Retain Your Brain, the scientists now, they have turned it, I'm not sure everyone behind it, but they're turning it into a free app. So it is actually like having a neurologist in your pocket.
I like that.
Yes. Wow. And one of the scientists behind it is Richard Isaacson, who, you know, I like, he gives webinars. Right now he's giving webinars on, you know, Ask a Brain Doc, but basically on Retain Your Brain. And I'm a beta tester. I volunteered. They were looking for volunteers to be a beta tester for their software. You take questionnaires, you do some cognitive tests, which, look, nobody likes taking a cognitive test. Believe me, I've taken a bunch of them. And then they give you, based upon your answers about your health, about your lifestyle, about different things, routines that are tailored to you. So, and then one thing I like about it, not to get too much in the weeds, is they actually show you the scientific studies behind each of the routines. And there's a lot of, you know, short courses and things. And that, after the beta testing, my understanding is that's going to be free. There's also a site, ind.org/learn-institute-of, which is from the Institute of Neurodegenerative Diseases. There are lots of short classes you can take. So, you know, a lot of times you can't go out to a class or, you know, or maybe you can't travel. But there are a lot of things we can learn on our phones, on our computers, on our tablets.
wonderful. Actually, I'm also participating in a study called the PREVENT study, and it's either getting a statin or getting a sugar pill.
Oh.
And they're following memory. They're, again, hoping it will improve your memory and just keep you healthier in general. So I think it lasts 5 years. And I don't know if I'm taking a sugar pill or a statin, but I might be able to cheat because my lab might be drawn by my regular doctor. And then I'll know if, you know, some of the lipid numbers or the cholesterol numbers are down. But okay, so in your book, you very well highlighted the different stages. So the preclinical phase, symptoms can begin 20 years before diagnosis. What were her first symptoms?
You know, that's such a kind of interesting question because I looked at all of her initial symptoms and thought that she didn't have an issue. And it was actually our out-of-town relatives who would come and stay in the house with her and spend periods of time
so they could see changes.
So they could see changes. And so maybe they'd be there for Christmas. And then maybe they come back for the summer so they could see changes. And my mother was very socially, I would like to say, you know, she's my mom, right? She was socially gifted.
Well, no, they're adept at covering up.
They're adept at covering up. So if you're at a restaurant and, you know, she's looked at the menu and she can't remember what is it that she wants to order, you know, she'll say, oh, what Dr. Joyce is having sounds so good. I'll have what you're having. But really, she's saying that because she can't remember. Or if she can't quite remember a word or a name, she would just say, oh, it's you. I'm so happy to see you. You know, but really what was going on there was she really couldn't remember. Or if I had told her a story and she really couldn't remember the story, she would just act like she could remember the story. And I had relatives, you know, family dynamics can be very difficult when someone has Alzheimer's, you know. And we had relatives who were keeping a list of all of the kooky things mom was doing. And we were quite offended by that list, you know. And we said, no, you know, to the extent she's having any type of issue, this is aging and you all are overreacting and you don't know. We live here after all. But there was one evening where it just became too in your face to deny. And my mother had always loved to cook big meals for the family. You know, it was kind of one of her acts of love. I mean, she enjoyed making certain recipes that she made every year. She would set like a nice table, although now in retrospect, things got less formal and less formal. I think because, you know, she did old-fashioned Southern things. She was from East Texas, like setting place cards and, you know, doing all these lovely things. And there were no place cards, but she would say, oh, it's because we're welcoming the new, more formal age of living, you know? But really, that's because she just couldn't manage it. And that night, you know, she had been cooking these recipes for decades, but cooking is a very complicated skill. You know, you have to manage ovens, you have to manage ingredients, you have to manage measurements, you have to manage time. And it just became very clear, you know, at 10 o'clock when we were going to eat early because we had little kids, you know, she just couldn't manage the complexity of cooking. And that was one of her That was the mm-hmm. moment where everyone said, okay, there's clearly something going on here.
Something wrong. Well, it's interesting because, again, on all those resources, the Alzheimer's Association or ALZ.org, again, has the 10 symptoms that, you know, we all look at and we go, oh, my gosh, is that happening? But it's, again, everything is a bell-shaped curve. And so you may be in the normal stage of it. You don't know if you're in the 20 years of the preclinical, but it's memory loss that disrupts daily life, forgetting recently learned information. So you may not have heard quite the name of someone, and so you don't remember that, but you know, there are other factors, associated with that, like the room was noisy or this or that. But yeah, then not following a conversation is also one of the signs of Alzheimer's. And what you said about cooking is sometimes when it takes me longer to make a recipe, it's like, oh my gosh. But then I think, well, I'm kind of multitasking. I'm doing this and then I'm doing this and then I'm doing this. But again, we all kind of go, is that on the beginnings or is it just a normal variant? Or are we, you know, on this trajectory to really progress?
Yeah. And Dr. Joanne, let me tell you, my son has asked me, or I have asked him more correctly, probably 7 times this summer, he's home from school, if he's made his dentist appointment. And every time I ask him, he's in, and I love him very much, but he's not. Every time I ask him, he says, we already discussed this. But the truth is, I'm cognitively fine. I am just not paying attention. And the minute he says, we discussed this, you remember? And I instantly remember everything that we discussed. So Dr. Joanne's right, because sometimes you're multitasking. Maybe you're not really paying attention. Some other things I noticed with my mom was just a rainbow of post-it notes of things that she used to remember, like post-it notes by the phone, lists, a lot of lists of things to do that she used to not need a list for. At one point, she took all of her clothes outside of her closet and put it in a spare room in kind of her writing office and laid them out. And when I asked about that, she said, well, I'm cleaning out my closet because I have a lot of clothes that I don't wear anymore. And I wear a small fraction of my clothes, which I think we can probably all relate to. But the clothes never made it back into the closet. And I think that's because that was the way she could manage, you know, what am I going to wear today? She needed to look at everything, and that made it easier for her.
So she actually wore some of those clothes. They weren't just abandoned.
So. No. So she actually did wear some of those clothes.
Susie, do you have some comments?
Well, a couple questions or a couple thoughts from listening to you and your story and your journey with your mother. It sounds like things were happening early. But my question is, does early detection, if we know these things, it doesn't necessarily mean Alzheimer's, but it's decline, we'll say. Is there a benefit to early, we'll call it detection or awareness, that can help? I know the research is still happening, but things that can happen that might mitigate or calm the journey forward.
Well, that might get me into the diagnosis part.
Okay.
Is that if you have a definite diagnosis, and so again, history, physical, complete neurological exam, lab that can rule out whether you have other things or part of the physical exam. Like if you have heart disease and your brain's getting anoxic, it's kind of what we thought with my mother-in-law, and that she had a heart block. So when her heart block, when she got a pacer, we thought then the blood would go more to her brain and she'd be more alert. Well, it didn't really, you know, change it that much. But you want to rule out something else. So hypothyroidism, a B12 deficiency, cardiopulmonary things. But then there are two specific tests, one on spinal fluid and one on blood, and also doing the CAT scan or the MRI. So when you asked about early, if you then would go to a, and I'm going to talk to Mary too a little bit more, but your family doctor, a neurologist, and then the test is, it's called the Lumipulse, and it was just approved in May of 25. And it's actually getting the tau protein and the beta amyloid on your blood. So it's an easier test. In 22, they did those protein tests for those proteins on your spinal fluid, which means you had to have a lumbar puncture, someone sticking a needle in your, between your vertebrae of your back. So now they can find that. And the two newest meds are like monoclonal antibodies that are given by infusion. They're very expensive. And so you kind of think, oh, I'll do the normal things first, like vitamin E, eating well, maybe this Aricept, which helps with memory supposedly. And we'll talk about that a little more in just a few minutes. But you don't do those things first. To halt the progression, you have to do the monoclonal antibody. So we'll see over the years with research, with funding, what's going to happen. But it's an infusion every 2 weeks for one of the drugs, Leqembi, and every 4 weeks or 3 weeks for donanemab. So those are big medical words you don't really need to know, but they're what you're hearing about, IV infusions to slow the progression of Alzheimer's. So they're expensive, so you have to have documented tau and beta amyloid in your system.
And that's able to be done now through blood tests.
Yes. So that brings us to Mary. And after your father died and the signs and symptoms became more obvious, she'd been diagnosed previously, though. I didn't realize that. So it was a year before you had started on the diagnostic journey.
Yeah, about 6 months before. Yeah.
And then how did it go? Was it her family doc and then the neurologist?
She had actually been religiously, because she cared about her health, going to her family doctor every year, who had been doing a cognitive test. Yeah. But a lot of family practitioners, maybe they don't know the signs of Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, or, you know, particularly at that time, because this was way back in 2011, you know, they may not know kind of what the next steps could be. And I'll say even today, through my aunt has recently been diagnosed as well. I live in Houston. She lives in a much smaller town. And you may need to advocate for yourself about these new medications, because some of the medical professionals may not, I mean, primary care doctors, they can't be familiar with everything, you know, just like lawyers. I'm a retired lawyer, you know, so you may need to ask some questions and ask about that. But she went, you know, we have the advantage of the medical center in Houston. So she was able to go to the Houston Medical Center and be seen by someone who specialized in dementia. And she, I believe, was one of, you know, the very early people who did some of the PET scans to get a diagnosis. But because before that time, you couldn't diagnose it until, you know, after death.
Big plaque. So she had a PET scan, a nuclear test where that takes up, glucose is taken up by abnormal cells.
Yeah, and one thing I did want to add just about early diagnosis, but from a caregiver's perspective, not from a medical perspective, is, you know, apart from what you just rightly said about, you know, the new medications, they're at the very early stages of the disease, you can also have a lot of emotional benefits. Mm-hmm. If you're the person who's been diagnosed, you know, before the disease progresses too much, you could have more of a say of how, you know, where you want to live, how you want things to go, who do you want to care for you. So a lot of emotional benefits in terms of planning for the future, your end of life decisions. I mean, I know that's not pleasant to talk about. And your legal documentation. Because at a certain point during this disease, you lose the legal capacity to bind yourself in a legal document. And from my personal experience with my mother, the fact that she had, you know, her directive to physicians in order, a medical power of attorney, financial power of attorney, she had all of her ducks in a row in terms of legal documentation, which will vary by state. So you need to find someone locally who can help you through that process. That makes life a lot better for the caregiver. And I believe that it makes life a lot better for the person living with Alzheimer's, because they have an opportunity to have, you know, more of a say. Now, a lot of my friends, tell me if I'm going on too long, they find that their parents are very resistant, if it's their parents or their friends or whoever. They're very resistant to putting all this documentation in place because, you know, maybe they feel like it's their business. It's not your business. Or maybe people feel like someone's going to take advantage of me, like, or they just don't want to do that. So you may need to take kind of a phased in approach, or sometimes having a neutral third party talk to your loved one might be helpful. I try to include different strategies for scenarios like that that can come up, just practical suggestions from my own life and from talking to other people that maybe will help you through that process. Mm-hmm. But not everyone's like my parents who handed me an envelope of documents.
That's amazing. I mean, again, be prepared. You can be prepared as a Girl Scout, but you can also be prepared as we age throughout our life cycle. Just want to do a station ID. This is 88.5 KRFY Pondere. And I have here with me Mary Moreland, who was a caregiver for her mother with Alzheimer's, and Susie Perez. Susie, did you have a question?
Well, I'm just thinking you're talking about a timeline from when it's discovered to a progression. Does it always end in death? Or does it, can it linger a long time? Or is there a normal amount of time or a standard amount of time so that when you first notice it and you want to get all this documentation and things set in place to take care of things, because some people will be denying it for a long time.
Yes.
And that denial can sabotage the support that you're going to need it throughout this process.
Well, it's interesting, as I know it, I mean, the preclinical, Mary did a great job of listing in the book, preclinical, mild cognitive impairment, and then the real parts of dementia is being early or mild, moderate, and severe. So on that continuum, people vary on the continuum in the number of years, okay. Or were they preclinical or mildly cognitively impaired, and no one really paid attention. Mm-hmm. And so then we go from, can you live alone in your house? Can you live alone in your house with a caregiver? Do you need to be in a assisted living facility? And then the memory unit. And so that's one of the next things we're going to be talking about. So just a question, though, about the treatment. Your mom was on Aricept, I think. Is that what I remember? Did you think? I never thought Aricept helped my mother-in-law, who also had dementia.
Yeah, she was on Aricept, and then we supplemented with Namibda.
Okay.
After a number of years. And then you get to a point where you've kind of maxed out on those medications. But the one time I did notice the benefit of Aricept was after my dad had passed away. And before I had gone through all of her medical cabinet, she stopped taking the Aricept. And I don't know if it was from not taking the Aricept because she couldn't remember to take the Aricept, or the upheaval of, you know, a death in the family and the routine and everything being interrupted. But once I went through her medical cabinets, I made sure she was on all of the correct medication she was supposed to be on. I did see that it helped her. But I don't know if that was from Aricept. That could have just been from other things.
So the medicines we've mentioned, Aricept and Namenda, are to kind of increase the enzymes that work on alertness. And those were traditionally the medicines that people took. But just briefly about the early treatments with the monoclonal antibody, Medicare does cover them, but other insurances are evolving. So, you know, we need to follow a longer time, so that proves to people, insurance executives or whatever, their consultants, their doctors who are their consultants, that these medicines work. So there's the preliminary trials or the first 5 years, but to continue to show that they slow the progression is usually how companies decide to pay for it. Her timeline seemed a little longer again than what I knew from my mother-in-law, but again, maybe we just weren't realizing it. And she went from living alone in Florida to living alone in Ohio in an independent living place, doing some weird things like falling asleep at the bridge table or putting a lock on her door so that her bedroom door so people couldn't come in. And because there's a lot of anxiety, fear, and paranoia with this too. So those are other medicines, just a little segue. Mm-hmm. Those are other medicines that people sometimes get to treat the anxiety or the paranoia. I mean, she would always go, don't you lock your doors? You know, lock the screen door. No, we leave that open to the deck when we're here. You know, or why are the cars going down the street? We lived on a circle. So if the busy traffic from downtown in Columbus, if people thought they were getting a shortcut, no, they had to go around. But mainly it was people who lived on the street who just wanted to park on the other side of the street. So they came and went around the circle. But there was a lot of anxiety and paranoia.
Yeah, and my mother went through, very deep into her disease, she went through a very aggressive stage where she, I remember I met her where she was living. At this time, she was in a assisted living facility. She was on the memory care floor, and someone was putting a plate down for her to eat lunch, which startled her, and she tried to kind of attack that person because she didn't know what was going on. And her doctor did put her on an antipsychotic medication, which I know is controversial to a lot of people, but I will say that very much helped her be calmer and have a better quality of life in our case.
Yeah. I remember reading an article actually in our Sandpoint paper about a gentleman whose wife was in the throes of dementia and becoming aggressive and you know, having a terrible knockdown, drag out fight at the age of, you know, 90 or something,
yeah.
Which, you know, seems, you know, startling to people. And it was all about her journey with dementia. So you are the ultimate multitasker. People call me a multitasker, but you had a single mom with two young sons, a mom with dementia, and a career as an attorney. So how did you balance all that? And then making that, we'll talk about the transitions when your mom had to leave her family home to the assisted living, to the other facility, to a memory unit.
You know, I get asked that all the time. And sometimes I think, and I'm like, how did I manage all of that? But first of all, I'd say I was very fortunate that I am a lawyer. Because, you know, I've made a decent income and I had, you know, means for childcare and all of that. And I do think, as perverted as this sounds, being a single parent sort of helped me a little bit because I was used to managing other people and what they would do all day and like how they would get there and all of that. But, you know, it was a challenge and, you know, every minute was very busy. And I'll say in retrospect, I should have found ways to probably take better care of myself and ask for more help. But I think a lot of times people who assume that caregiver role, you know, they're kind of the people who do multitask. They're the people who do it all. They're the people who don't want to, you know, take the time to explain to you how it is that you can help me. And people used to say all the time, well, let me know if I can help you. And really, I would think, well, to spend the time to think about how is it that you could assist me may be difficult for me. So I'd rather just handle it. But once I kind of learned how I can work with other people and how to find resources, like, for example, my brother, one of them lives in Los Angeles. He obviously can't help with the day-to-day, but what we discovered was he was excellent at research. So I would give him research projects. So when mom needed to move, when we decided, you know, maybe she should move to assisted living, he was in charge of researching locations and coming up with a short list that we could all talk about.
Oh, that's really interesting because I was going to ask again. Lots of times when there are siblings, you're taking care of her, and so then you're the special person, so, you know, they might feel left out. So it sounded like you and your siblings were pretty much on track, and maybe it was that dinner that got them on track together.
Yeah, but I think it took a while for us to find our rhythm. I, you know, like I said before, the family dynamics, when, you know, in our case with a parent, can be very kind of difficult to maneuver. And if you're the person there day by day by day, you may see things that need to be done, or you may be having conversations where someone says, your mom really needs to have more care. You know, she's shouldn't be on the independent living floor anymore. She needs to have some additional help. And your sibling, well, first myself, sometimes I would have a hard time accepting that.
Mm-hmm.
I think because I just didn't want that to be true,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then I would need to have conversations with my siblings, and it may take a while for them, you know, to accept that. So I feel for people because I think that family dynamic piece can be challenging at first. And what I found was also once I started really asking people, not just what's going on right now, what do we want to do right now, but, you know, doctor, tell me, what are the next few things we need to be thinking of as a family? What are the things that you see that could go wrong? You know, at the place where she lived, what are the signs that we should be looking for to see that she's really advanced and needs more support? Mm-hmm. So once I really started kind of being a bit more proactive, and then I could sort of plant the seeds with my sibling, you know, like, our doctor said that this may come up as she gets, you know, more and more progressed in the disease. Let's go ahead and have a conversation about that. Let's talk about like a feeding tube, for example. Like, let's talk about all these kind of specifics. Like, you know, what do you guys think about that? So I think once I started kind of acting like a lawyer more, because, you know, in the area of law that I practice, you really have to be always thinking about what's going to go wrong. And then trying to mitigate for that. Once I started training my brain to think about, you know, what is going to happen if I can't pick my kids up from school, or the person who's helping me pick my kids up from school can't make it, who am I going to call? Like, maybe I should go ahead and have a list of resources.
Mm-hmm.
And I also found, you know, other resources. Like, I found, I thought this was a genius business, this a woman in town had started a business of taking inventory of your loved ones' supplies, which I thought was so smart. and fortunately, you know, I mean, I was a lawyer. So like I said, I was fortunate enough to have the means. But that actually saved me money because I never knew what mom needed. So I was kind of buying all the wrong, like too much of this and not enough of that. And then I found that where she lived, they already had a relationship with a pharmacy, which instead of me going to Walgreens, and of course now you have, you know, home delivery and different things like that, but they already had certain relationships that I could take advantage of, if that makes sense.
Okay. And then when she was in her home, you had to find a caregiver that you trusted. Did you use a private agency? And
so we were really in a rush to find someone because, you know, my first instinct was I just want to stay home and be with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just want to stop working. I'm going to stay home. I want to take care of mom. That's what I'm going to do. But then, you know, very quickly it became clear that that was not really a realistic scenario for me. And we found caregivers through word of mouth.
Okay.
And then afterwards, when she went to a point where she needed 24-hour care, I supplemented with an agency. But the agency was tricky because sometimes the person who's supposed to come can't come, and then you have a stranger in the house, and she didn't like that. So
I know my mother-in-law would be in the hospital, and she'd accept the person for the first few days who came and checked on her once she got discharged, and then all of a sudden she'd go, no, I'm fine today, and not unlock the door, you know?
I mean,
you know, because there's part of that paranoia in there, too, or anxiety, and she didn't want anybody else to come in. But one of your chapters is on effective communication with your loved one, so I'd like to talk about that a little bit, because it was so interesting that when they finally get to the inability to carry on a conversation, that's the hardest part. But in that transition, when you could talk with her, tell us a little bit about the best way to communicate with someone who's losing their memory?
Well, I think you have to have a lot of patience. You know, not let it bother you that she's repeated the same questions multiple times. Be very clear. And one thing, and I think maybe this is best illustrated by an example. You know, one time we had gone out to do things and I was taking her back by her house. And, you know, she had lived in this house for almost 50 years. So you'd think she would always recognize her house. And we got there and I said, okay, you know, we're going to go inside and I'm going to leave you at the house. And then I'm going to, you know, go back to do X, Y, and Z. And so-and-so is there. And she looked at me and said, this is not, where are we? Like, this is not my house. Why would you drop me here? Like, what are you doing? You know, and was really upset with me. And I had to remind myself of the end goal, because the end goal there is not to convince mom that this is her house, which is what normally we want to do, you know. And in my legal training, I persuade people by showing you the evidence, like I show you the reason for this, you know, I remind you of something. But there, the end goal is we want mom to go in the house. It really breaks my heart. She doesn't remember this house at this particular moment, but that doesn't really matter. So maybe the approach is, well, I need to go inside. Would you come inside with me? Would you mind just coming inside with me to this house? Because I need to get something inside the house. And, oh, yes, you know, I would love to do that. You know, so you have to kind of find little tricks, I guess. And just one other thing, if I may, communicating with her about not driving, which is such a common thing with people, was terrible, because how can the people she taught how to drive, these children who she probably never thought I was a very good driver, is taking away her car keys. And we had so many arguments about that until we realized that really she didn't want to drive. She was scared to drive, I think. And I think in retrospect, she may have gotten kind of lost a few times. What she wanted was the knowledge that she had the control to drive if she wanted to drive. So we ended up getting a car key that looked exactly like her car key and putting it in the place of her car key. And she would go and check to see if her car key was there, because then that meant she could drive, and she never mentioned it again. Wow. And another, yeah, very quick thing, because I think it might be helpful, was we had some boxes in the garage. And I had obviously been over a lot. And she concocted, because I think sometimes when you don't know the whole story and your mind isn't quite working the right way, my unscientific view is that you try to put things together and create a story of what's going on. And the story she had created in her mind, because there were these moving boxes in the garage, was that Mary was kicking her out of her house and she was going to be on the streets of Houston because Mary's moving in with her children. And she actually called a lot of people and told them I was kicking her out. And I got some very funny phone calls from people, because people who knew me knew that that wasn't true. But she had not, you know, I mentioned the sticky notes before. The brain is a funny thing, because she knew how to read. She understood a lot of kind of simple reading material. So once we put in black Sharpie on those boxes, Jane's belongings belongs to Jane. Jane's stuff. You know, the whole story of Mary is now kicking me out of my house just disappeared.
Just changed. I was going to ask you, what is your mother's name?
Jane.
Okay. Yes.
Your book is about hope in a way. It's the good beneath. I think that's what it's called.
The gap between.
The gap between. So, you know, having information, this isn't supposed to, it is disconcerting. It's something everyone faces. Every family is going to be affected, is what I'm hearing you say. Mm-hmm. But having information can help navigate when the time comes in different ways. As you say, you have to be a little bit creative and pay attention to instead of having her sit there with the anxiety that you're kicking her out, put her name on the boxes. And that took care of everything. Or the key story.
Yeah, the key. And once I've discovered the fake car key, I was fake credit carding. I was fake checkbooking.
Oh, that's amazing.
Because she just, you know, she was used to having those things and she wanted
keep, you know, some normal
control.
She wanted control. She's like me.
Schedule.
I'm a bit of a control freak. You know?
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, that came up too, that you said you had always been in control, and then watching the progression of the disease. I think the communication piece is really interesting because two things, one thing I've kind of heard you say, and then another friend when we were talking about someone whose memory seemed to be going, is you can't over-explain. And that's kind of the way some parents do to young children nowadays, too. It's like you don't need to over-explain. I mean, they're not going to follow it. It's just you're bringing it up too much. Distract or talk about something else. So you're, well, let's go in the house. Or like, you know, I would say to parents or my own kids, it's like, how fast can you make it up the stairs when they didn't want to go to bed? I mean, it wasn't talking about going to bed. It was running up the stairs.
That's a perfect example of the changes to pay attention to. Keep it simple now. In the past, you explained everything to your mother, but now it's different. Things have changed.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And also, especially later on in her disease, if she got confused or upset, you know, it's sometimes just saying, I see you're upset. Just validating that she was upset would make her feel better. And sometimes I would just start singing, to be honest. And I always sang, You Are My Sunshine. And she would just, I kept it to the first verse, but she would start singing as well. So when I really didn't know what to do, I would just start singing.
Okay. And they say music really is something that soothes the soul. We know that's true, but it also streams through our life forever.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're coming sort of to the end of our show. There are a couple of quotes that I thought were really interesting from your book. The wardrobe may have changed, but your loved one can still look dignified. I kind of like that, and minimize and organize that closet. So once she went to the independent or the assisted living and then the memory unit, you had to keep things a little more organized, and you had to be more involved in the organization and getting the supplies. It's interesting, again, my mother-in-law, you'd buy her something and then it would be inadvertently walk away. So did someone who also had memory problems walk in the room, or did the staff decide they were going to share it? I still don't really know. But in your decisions and transitions, it seems like your family did a really good job of working together. So there wasn't that, you know, Mary's doing this and, you know.
I think we learned how to work together. Okay. Yeah.
And then when you chose going to hospice, I thought, again, that's one of the saddest transitions. And Susie asked about the progression and does everyone die? What happens to most people is they have trouble swallowing and then they don't eat. And then in the meantime, you've noticed for the last year, 6 months, year, 3 years, that you don't have a conversation. And so they're kind of just mumbling gibberish and they want to say something, but you can't understand a word they're saying. So that hospice palliative care is always really helpful.
Yeah. And one thing I learned, I just wanted to pass along. I had always thought that hospice was when you're really on death's door. And so that's when I contacted hospice, you know, when I knew mom, you know, was really on the way out, for lack of a better term. But I learned that people with Alzheimer's, they can actually qualify for hospice much earlier. And they were very helpful. I hadn't realized that.
Okay. Well, I wanted to know how you're doing, but I think I sort of know you're working through everything. And the book was a wonderful way to probably get out your feelings and not coming completely to closure, but at least coming to closure in a way.
And it sounds like to help others.
Yeah, I mean, that was my purpose in writing it. I actually didn't initially intend to write a book, but I showed someone what I wrote who said, wow, this could really be helpful for other people. And then I thought, you know, why not share some of this knowledge? You know, everybody shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. And my story, not everyone's going to relate to my story. You know, we're all different, but I'm hopeful, and the purpose in writing it was really to give it to the younger Mary Moreland's people starting the journey as kind of Alzheimer's 101, just to share practical information in a conversational tone.
Well, it's really a wonderful book, and we have so many good resources, which I'm going to mention. Mary, thank you so much for your contributions to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne, talking about Alzheimer's disease and caregiving. Your experience is so invaluable to our listening community, and thank you all for listening. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your medical provider. If you missed any part of the program, you can catch the show at krfy.org under the podcast tab. And for more information, refer to the Alzheimer's Association, ALZ.org, and their 24-hour helpline, 1-800-272-3900. ALZinfo.org is another good source, and the National Institute on Aging. Hope you'll listen in again for our December show on December 1st and December 15th. This is KRFY 88.5 Ponderay.